When you think about making a dessert or a cocktail or even a main course, I'll bet vinegar isn't top of the mind as an ingredient. Hi, Jill Nadeau here. I'm filling in for Larry today. Our guest says vinegar can make most recipes taste better, and that includes dessert, drinks, and dinner. On the phone from New York is Harry Rosenblum. He's the co-owner of a cooking school called the Brooklyn Kitchen. That's the name of it. Co-founder of the Meat Hook, a whole animal butcher shop that specializes in local meat from small family farms, and the host of the podcast, Feast Your Ears. His new book is Vinegar Revival, artisanal recipes for brightening dishes and drinks with homemade vinegar. Do you make your own vinegar? Well, what questions do you have about cooking with it? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page. Just look for The Larry Mueller Show. So, Harry, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I always love to talk about vinegar.
It sounds like it. And you sound like you're a very, very busy man. How in the world did you find time to write a book?
Well, the publisher approached me about writing the book.
Oh.
It was not something that I had considered writing about, but it's something that I've been making vinegar for about 14 years at home. And the publisher found me. They asked a couple of their authors, who happen to be friends of mine, if they knew anyone that knew anything about vinegar. And my name came up a few times. And so they contacted me a couple of years ago and said, would you write a book about vinegar for us?
Wow.
And so I did.
Well, most authors are very jealous right now listening to this. They usually have to shop around their book.
Yeah, no, I was lucky.
Yeah, definitely. So did they know that vinegar was kind of like an up-and-coming thing? Or why did they decide that they needed a book about vinegar?
Well, I think so. I mean, vinegar has been appearing. I mean, vinegar is, you know, thousands of years old. But
right.
in the sort of last 10 years or so of the kind of, you know, the modern food movement, if you will, vinegar has become more and more popular. And I think, you know, balsamic vinegar, everybody knows balsamic vinegar and olive oil kind of became a hot thing and starting in the 70s when gourmet European food became a thing in this country. And in the past 10 years, there's just been more and more vinegar makers popping up both here and in Europe, and the availability of good vinegar in the marketplace has skyrocketed. And I think that the next step of that was to talk about how to make it at home. You know, we are in a movement with food where the idea of the artisan, the idea of making things from scratch yourself, whether that's making sausage, whether that's making beer, vinegar was a natural extension of that.
That's right. And, well, you know, when we make things at home, it's generally because we like the whole process or because the things that we get in the supermarket aren't necessarily the best thing. Is that the case with vinegar?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, I made fermented sausage, dry cured sausage at home once, and I wouldn't do it again. I know how the sausage is made, as they say, and it was a great experience, and I understand the process, but the home environment was not really well suited to making a quality product.
I can understand that.
Vinegar, on the other hand, is very easy to make at home, and by and large, you can make something that's as good or better than a lot of what you can buy in the store. You know, take red wine vinegar as an example. In the grocery store, a lot of what you're seeing is made from low-quality wine, so not something you might want to drink as a wine is the starting place for it. And what you can make at home is going to end up being cheaper and a much better quality. And you can use the dregs of your wine bottle if you have that left over, or you can buy wine that tastes pretty good and make vinegar yourself.
And that's key, right, is getting what you start with needs to taste good first.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, good input is going to equal good output, certainly true with vinegar.
So how can you tell if you have a good vinegar? I mean, what are the characteristics?
So I think the characteristics of a good vinegar are that it tastes good by itself. For me, I always like to taste vinegars just straight. I know, you know, a lot of people may not like that. It is very sharp. It is very acidic, and I'm not recommending that you like, you know, chug.
It's a little unusual, Harry. Yeah,
but you take a little bit on a spoon and you taste it. And for me, a good vinegar is one where you can tell what it was made from. So, you know, a not very good vinegar is just going to taste really sharp. It's going to be really acidic. It's going to almost burn your tongue, and it's not really going to have any flavor components. And what you want is to be able to taste what that came from. If it's a malt vinegar, you want it to taste like beer. But sharper. If it's a wine vinegar, you want it to taste like white wine or red wine or rosé or sherry, whatever it started out from, and not just like a pink-colored acidic liquid.
Oh, well, that was a wonderful description. I take it you've done that before. Yeah. Now, people are eating fermented foods for health these days. Now, can vinegar also be thought of that way?
Sure. I mean, there is a lot of anecdotal evidence to say that, you know, consuming raw foods and raw vinegar specifically is good for you. I certainly find that it makes me feel good. I drink a little bit of vinegar usually in a glass of seltzer every morning. And if you're making it at home, you can be sure that it's as probiotic as possible.
Sure.
Even if you're purchasing raw vinegar in the store, one thing to remember is that those bacteria, the acetobacter that are converting the ethyl alcohol into acetic acid, which is what makes vinegar, those bacteria need oxygen to live just like we do. So if those bacteria, even if the vinegar is raw, are sealed in a glass bottle for an extended period of time, meaning years, mm-hmm. they're going to die.
Yes.
So you may have an unpasteurized vinegar. That doesn't mean that there's any living probiotics still in the jar, depending on how long it's been sitting in the glass.
Okay.
So by making it at home, much like something, you know, much like making your own kombucha, you can be sure that when you're consuming it, you're consuming a lot of live probiotic bacteria.
Okay. Well, let's get to it. What do you need to make vinegar?
So it's incredibly simple. You need some kind of beverage that contains alcohol. That you know, ideally something you like the taste of, whether that's beer, wine, sake, hard cider, all of those will work. You need some kind of a vessel to keep it in. You can use a barrel. You can use a stoneware crock. In Europe, it's very popular, especially in France, to find a stoneware crock with a spigot on it that you would just keep on the counter, and you would pour a little bit from every bottle of wine you open into there. And you know, you have a vinegar mother growing. And then the other thing you need is the bacteria. You need some live vinegar bacteria. And when I say the mother, what I'm talking about is similar, if any of the listeners know or make their own kombucha, you get this kind of slimy cellulose raft that grows on the top of your kombucha, and vinegar is the same. So that is, in fact, a byproduct of the fermentation. But it tells us visually that the bacteria are there because we can't see the bacteria with the naked eye.
Okay.
So you can use a piece of that gelatinous mother if you happen to have some, or you can order it from numerous places online. You can order it from us at thebrooklynkitchen.com. Or you need some raw vinegar. And so any raw vinegar, Bragg's is a very popular one that's available nationwide. You can pour some of their vinegar into there as a starter. And essentially, you just need to let it sit. So you take your alcoholic beverage. You need to add some kind of live bacteria in some kind of a vessel. A quart or half-gallon ball jar is a great option. And then the key thing is you want to leave it open. Unlike a lot of other fermentation, people who are familiar with making beer know that in beer making you put an airlock on the vessel so that as you're fermenting you don't want any oxygen in there.
Right.
The bacteria need the oxygen. They can't convert the alcohol into acetic acid without oxygen. So you want that to be open, but you want to cover it with a piece of cloth. So you want to take your jar, you want to put your alcoholic liquid in there, you want to water it down a little bit if it's a higher proof. If you're dealing with like a wine that's in a 14-15% range, you want to water that down by at least a third to a half because the bacteria don't like alcohol percentages above about 9%. And then you put a piece of cheesecloth, a piece of an old T-shirt, and a rubber band around the neck of the jar because you don't want flies to get in there. You know, there's an old saying, you catch more flies with vinegar than honey.
Yeah.
And that's true. Flies love vinegar. And in fact, fruit flies are, you know, sort of like nature's, they're like the Johnny Appleseed of the vinegar bacteria because they're landing on fruit where the bacteria already exists and they're moving it around from fruit to fruit to fruit or possibly into your wine or into your beer as you're making it. And then you just leave that jar in a, you know, in a warm spot. You can leave it on top of your refrigerator. You can leave it in the cabinet. When I first started making vinegar, I left it in my boiler room. And you just kind of leave it alone and let it do its thing. I mean, the input from us as humans is pretty small. The bacteria really do all the heavy lifting. And in, you know, anywhere from 3 to 4 weeks to 2 to 3 months, depending on environmental factors, depending on how strong the bacteria is that you're starting from with your batch, and depending on your alcohol percentage, you will then have vinegar. And the best way to know that it's ready is to taste it.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing that can grow in it that can harm you. You can get some yeasts or some molds that grow on there that aren't going to taste good. And I certainly would not suggest if it doesn't taste good, I would not suggest drinking all of it. But basically you'll know. And so when it starts to smell acidic, you can start to taste it. And as soon as it is in a place that you like it, you can start, you know, you can start using it.
Okay. Well, we actually have a caller who would like a little more information. His name is Robert, and he's calling from Mosinee. Hi, Robert. What's your question for Harry?
Hey, I have a sensitive stomach, and I was wondering if the acidicness will be too much for a sensitive stomach.
That's a good question. I do not have a sensitive stomach, but in my experience and from the information that I have at hand, your stomach acids are much more acidic than the vinegar itself. So on the pH scale, which runs from 0 to 14, anything below 4 is considered to be acidic, and on the sort of the real acid range of things, the vinegars that I make at home end up about 2.7 or so, 2.6 sometimes at the low end. Our stomach acid is about a 1. So I doubt it, but I wouldn't recommend that you start, you know, like I taste a lot of vinegars and I just, you know, I'll shoot them straight and take a sip. I would suggest that maybe you try a little bit in a glass of water at first and see how it does for you.
Okay. Well, good luck with that, Robert. Hopefully you'll experiment with that, because that would be kind of fun, I think. Tell us, what recipe would you recommend for someone who's just, you know, they're listening to this show and they think, oh, you know what, I'd really like to try that. What would be a really easy first recipe to try?
Well, I mean, I think that once you've gotten to the making part, and, you know, I think it's worth pointing out that the book is a great book for people, even if you just like vinegar. You don't, you know, if you're not a home brewer and you're not used to having jars of things bubbling away in your kitchen, the book has recipes, and the recipes are all, you know, usable with homemade vinegar or store-bought vinegar. I would say one of the easiest, and certainly a great one for this time of year, would be to make switchel, which is an old-fashioned drink that is made from apple cider vinegar, maple syrup, ginger, and lemon.
Yeah, I was going to talk to you about that one, because that looked really interesting. And that you made a reference that is this the one that you thought maybe Laura Ingalls Wilder had talked about in her book?
So while I was writing Vinegar Revival, I was also in the process of reading all of the Laura Ingalls Wilder books to my daughter.
Okay.
And in the book, The Long Winter, she talks about how her mom brought out this drink that was ginger water sweetened with sugar and made tangy with vinegar, and how when they were cutting hay in the heat of the summer in the middle of the day, she references the fact that if they just drank straight water, it would upset their stomachs. And so they drank this, you know, what I sort of refer to as it's a proto energy drink or a proto Gatorade.
That's right. Yeah, that makes sense.
And it's incredibly refreshing. So, you know, the recipe is very simple. You take a half a cup of apple cider vinegar. You mix in 3 tablespoons of maple syrup. You could use honey as well if you don't have maple syrup on hand. 1 tablespoon of grated fresh ginger or 2 teaspoons of ground ginger works well too, but I like the fresh. I think it's a much brighter flavor. I find dry ginger sometimes just tastes a little earthy, almost like dirt.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I include a pinch of kosher salt just because I find that it brings out the flavor a little bit, and then you use a half a lemon, and you put all that together and mix it up. And if you do that in a quart jar, and then you fill the jar the rest of the way with water, and then you can drink it immediately. I like to refrigerate it for 3 or 4 hours just to kind of let the flavors mingle. But it's super refreshing, and, you know, it's my favorite thing to drink on a hot day.
Well, it does sound that way. And, you know, I've got to tell you that pretty much every recipe on every page is something I want to try. So it's a really good. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. And we're talking with Harry Rosenblum, author of the new book Vinegar Revival, Artisanal Recipes for Brightening Dishes and Drinks with Homemade Vinegar. We'd like you to get in the conversation, so give us a call. We have open lines. Call 800-642-1234. And, of course, you can always send us an email, and that's ideas@wpr.org. Coming up at 11:45, we're going to change direction a little bit and talk about mindfulness and how it's been helping teachers deal with stress. Hope you can stay with us. But right now we're talking about cooking with vinegar and actually making your own vinegar too. Harry, when I was looking through here, I saw all these recipes for shrubs. Okay, and for those who listen to our show, we do a garden show every Friday. This is not anything you plant around your house, right? What's a shrub? I had not heard of that before.
So a shrub is a preservation method for preserving fresh fruit by adding sugar and vinegar. And essentially, rather than making something like a jam, where you're adding a lot of sugar and cooking it down to gel that fruit, you're adding vinegar and sugar as a way to preserve and be able to use it as a liquid. And essentially, I like to describe shrubs as they're kind of like soda syrups. So people talk a lot about drinking vinegars, and now on the market you see a lot of things marketed as drinking vinegars, which are usually vinegar mixed with some kind of sugar, and they're sort of like soda syrups.
Okay.
And so it's a way that you can take, you know, fresh blueberries, for instance, or I have a strawberry rhubarb recipe, cranberries, and you basically, you know, you mix those things with sugar and heat them with vinegar, and then you strain out all the solids. And what you have is a delicious addition that you can use in your drinking and your cooking.
And again, they sound really good. And since, you know, Wisconsin is the leading producer of cranberries in the United States,
sure,
we definitely want to try that cranberry one because that looks good. And you can use that in, like you said, in Thanksgiving. You know, you can put it in your cranberry sauce. I was like, what
Absolutely.
A great idea.
I mean, you can put it in your cranberry sauce and that'll, you know, it'll add the sharpness of the vinegar there.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we all think about cranberries at Thanksgiving, but that's not, you know, they're not ripe at the end of November.
Right.
So, you know, and people freeze them all the time.
Oh,
and, you
sure.
know, there's a lot of thing, and they last a long time on the shelf, but this way, you know, you can preserve them right at the height of the summer or early fall, and then you could use them on your table or in your drinks.
Okay. Well, we do have a few more phone calls coming in, Harry. Let's go to Pat in Three Lakes. Hi, Pat. What's your question?
Hi. I have a question. Is there a recipe for a low-sodium or sodium-free vinegar?
It's a good question. There is not inherently any sodium in vinegar at all, because the only ingredient in vinegar is whatever the alcohol beverage that you're starting from. So you can, you know, whatever you're starting from, unless you were working with something like a gozo, like a salt beer, there wouldn't naturally be any sodium in the vinegar that you're making.
In fact, a lot of people use vinegar in place of salt, right, to brighten up
Absolutely.
Recipes.
And that's one of the things that I point out in the book is that I think that, you know, a lot of people, I think that as you learn about cooking, we all know that salt adds flavor. And so certainly in restaurants, you know, everybody is aware, I think, and Pat, you're probably aware, that, you know, when you go out to eat at a restaurant, there's usually tons more salt in the food than you would ever use at home. But I think people fall into the trap as they start cooking more at home. Every time they think something needs a little more taste, they're adding salt.
Right.
And I encourage people to try adding vinegar instead. So, I mean, you know, one thing I would definitely encourage is that, you know, when you make scrambled eggs, put a little bit of vinegar on the eggs. Don't put any salt on them. And see what they taste like. And it really brightens them up is the best way to describe it. And, you know, you're adding a little bit of acid in there without having to add salt.
There you go, Pat. Well, I think you should try it. It makes sense. And I've been using vinegar in cooking for a long time, especially more savory things, and it tastes great. So, yeah, go out and try it. The next call we have is Jim in Cedarburg. Hi, Jim.
Harry, I have 2 1-gallon jugs of what was cherry wine with the cherries inside, okay, filled at the top with the liquid. It's very old, and it's got a loose cap on it, you know, loose screw cap, and how do I know it's good, and can I actually even consume the cherries?
Sure. I mean, you know, as with so many things, you know, and I'm always an advocate of your nose knows. So I would open them up, and I would give it a sniff, and if you aren't immediately repulsed, I would maybe pour some out into a glass or into a bowl, and if it still smells good, I would taste a little bit and see what it tastes like. You know, especially when you're doing something like that, I mean, certainly when you're making, you know, like when you're making the shrubs in the book, I advocate for keeping the solids. So when I make the strawberry rhubarb shrub and I press as much liquid out, I still have all the solids of the strawberry and the rhubarb, and that has a ton of flavor. And so I save that, and I put it in smoothies. I put it in my oatmeal. I eat it with yogurt. And then I use the liquid for something else. So I would say, I would guess that you could do the same thing with your cherries. And, you know, the other side of that is that if you smell it and it smells horrible, then it's probably time to throw it away. And, you know, one of the things that I've found over years of experiments in the kitchen is that they're not all going to be winners.
That's the truth. Well, thanks for the call, Jim. Appreciate that. Harry, we had someone call from Carol, actually, in Toma, to ask, what is mother of vinegar and how is it made? So could you explain
sure.
that a little bit?
Absolutely. So what we call the mother of vinegar, and I love the terminology, right? Like that there is something that is the parent
yes.
that is creating, or you know, that is passing on this legacy, and it really is. So what we call the mother of vinegar is this a cellulose raft that forms at the intersection of oxygen, in this case the air, and the surface of the liquid, and that's a byproduct of the bacteria. So the bacteria really is the mother, and there are millions of them in an active fermenting jar of vinegar that are converting molecules of alcohol in the presence of oxygen, they need oxygen to do this, into acetic acid. And then there's a byproduct, which is this cellulose that forms on the top. And it has a couple of purposes. It helps keep out things like mold spores that might land on that surface. And it also allows us as humans a visual cue that, oh, this fermentation is working. Much like if you're making, you know, sauerkraut, you can see the bubbles in there. You can't see the bacteria that are consuming some of the starches and the sugars in there and then releasing CO2, but you can see the bubbles rising up, and so you know that the bacteria is working. So the making of mother of vinegar, it happens naturally in the fermentation process. And that cellulose is, you could do things with it. You can eat it. You can, you know, use it as a fertilizer in your garden. I don't find it particularly, the texture is a little odd. I mean, it's sort of like weird and squishy and snotty kind of. I tend to not do anything with it except try to foist it on all my friends. And I say, here, you make some vinegar. But I think it's important to understand that you won't see that every time you make a vinegar. There's some variability depending on the bacteria and depending on the liquid. And that itself, while it has living bacteria in it, you can also start your new vinegar just from the liquid, as long as that liquid is a raw vinegar, because that will have plenty of bacteria in it.
Okay. Is that similar to, then, like a sourdough starter?
Very similar, yeah.
Okay.
And in fact, similar to a sourdough where, you know, you can put a bowl of flour and water out, like on your deck, and capture native yeast from the air.
Yes.
The Acetobacter is pretty much omnipresent. You know, it exists in the wild, it exists on fruits, it exists on vegetables, and really anywhere that those yeasts land where there's sugar, they're going to eat that sugar like in a fruit. So if you have, say, a pineapple on the tree or an apple that is ground fallen, you know, and then that starts to rot, what's happening is yeasts have colonized that and are there consuming the sugar and turning it into alcohol. And then, in fact, you have Acetobacter that then will land there where there's alcohol being produced and convert that into acetic acid, into vinegar.
It's a science experiment, right?
Absolutely.
Our guest today is Harry Rosenblum. He's the author of the new book, Vinegar Revival, Artisanal Recipes for Brightening Dishes and Drinks with Homemade Vinegar. We've got a couple of lines open, so give us a call if you have any questions about using or making vinegar. Our number is 1-800-642-1234, and we do have another call. Jeff in Oregon, what question do you have for Harry? Jeff?
What is the difference between raw vinegar and the white distilled vinegar you buy in a grocery store?
Great question. So raw vinegar, as it sounds, is raw. It's unpasteurized, and so it should have, you know, plenty of living bacteria as long as it hasn't been in that bottle for, you know, more than a year or so. The white distilled vinegar that you buy in the grocery store, and you know, that is a great product, is still produced by the same bacteria, except that it's produced in a very controlled laboratory setting. Often it is produced in enormously large batches where they pump oxygen, pure oxygen, into the liquid, and they're stirring it constantly. So they're increasing the availability of pure oxygen to the bacteria. So it's converting very fast, and they can also then convert to a very high percentage. So when you buy that in the supermarket, it's usually distilled to 4 or 5% alcohol. I mean, 4 or 5% acidity. Sorry. And but that usually starts out in some cases as high as 30% or more when they're done with the initial fermentation, and then it is distilled much the same way that vodka or a spirit is distilled. So they distill it, so they make it almost pure. So they make it into almost 100% pure acetic acid, and then add purified water back to it before they bottle it and you buy it. So they're making sure that it is completely pure acetic acid only. Whereas when you have raw vinegar, there might be other acids in there as well. Because apples, for instance, if you have apple cider vinegar, have other kinds of acid in there. There's malic acid, there's tartaric acid, there's other acids. Same thing in wine. Wine has a whole host of acids, acid compounds that are already in the wine. Those don't go away when you make vinegar. You're just converting all the alcohol into acetic acid, so you have more acetic acid than other acids.
Okay, well, great. Thank you for that call, Jeff. That explains a lot. Let's go to Kelly in Duluth. Hi, Kelly.
Good morning. I love to make pickles, and I'm wondering how you could use this in pickles and how you can check the pH to make sure you have enough acidity for pickles.
Oh, you have some great recipes for that, yeah.
So you can absolutely use homemade vinegar for pickling. You bring up a really good point. It is important to check the pH, and actually it's also important to check the percent acidity to make sure that your recipes are going to work. And pH and the acid percentage are not directly related, not directly correlated. But as anyone who does their own canning, who does their own pickling, likely knows, you want to make sure that your final product ends up below a pH of 4.0. With tomatoes or with pickles or anything that you're canning in a water bath situation that you want to be shelf stable. So any of the homemade vinegars can be used for refrigerator pickles because you also have the aid of cold in your refrigerator that's keeping those things from spoiling. And you can make delicious pickles even if your vinegar is not super acidic. That is totally safe to eat as long as you keep it in the refrigerator. If you want to make those things shelf stable, I recommend on the sort of low-cost end, picking up some pH test strips, and you want those to have a range between 2.0 and 4.0, and then you can test your homemade vinegar and see where it lands. And as long as you're ending up in the 2.7, 2.6, and below range, I would say you're absolutely safe to go ahead and use that in your homemade, in your shelf-stable vinegar. But I would take it one step further, and what I would do is I would make up a small batch of, let's say you were going to do cucumbers. I would make up a small batch, and I would take, say, an 8-ounce jar's worth or even a little less, some liquid and some of that vegetable after you've made that pickle, and I would put it in your blender. And I would blend it up, and then I would test the pH of that. Because really what you need to know in order to make sure it's going to stay shelf-stable and be safe is that your pH of everything that's in there, of your spices, of your vegetables, of the water, of the vinegar, is below 4.0. And as long as when you test that blended together slurry and it ends up below 4.0, then you can go ahead and can it. The other thing you could do is you can buy an acid titration kit, and that's usually used in winemaking, but you can use it, and I outline in the book how to use it for testing your homemade vinegar, and you can figure out what your acid percentage is. So you can find out whether or not the apple cider vinegar you've made at home has 3% acid, which is going to taste great and still taste acidic on your tongue, but not be quite acidic enough to use in your traditional pickling recipes, or whether it's 4 or 5 or 6 or even 7% acid.
Okay, well, great, Kelly. I think that you should try that and let us know how it works out. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Dan in Wisconsin Rapids. He has a question for us. Hi, Dan.
Yes, I've made vinegar, and I think it's great for people to try it. And what I did is I got some apple juice. I squeezed apples. It's not real easy to get a lot of juice out of apples. It takes some work. But I put it in a jug, and I just put a old clean sock on top and put a rubber band around that. And the mother came, everything came perfect. But my question is I found a bottle of vinegar that my grandfather had that had maybe been down in the cellar for 20 years, 30 years, I don't know how long, and the flavor did not get sharper. It just got more mellower, and maybe not as sharp. Is that what usually happens after the ages of long time?
Absolutely. I think that's great. I think there's two great things that you bring up. One is that you can start directly from juice and you can start directly from fruit. And like I mentioned before, the yeast to convert the sugar into alcohol and the bacteria to convert that alcohol into acetic acid, it's all right there on the fruit. So you took apples and you pressed them. You know, you sort of had everything there for you, and so it converted well into vinegar. That is the most, you know, sort of natural way to make it, and I definitely encourage people to do it, but as I'm sure you can attest, the grinding and the pressing of the apples is a lot of work, so that may not really be for everybody. As far as the aged vinegar, I think that's great. I mean, I will commend you, you know, for finding that. I mean, that's really neat that you found some a usable product that was made decades ago down in the cellar. As far as the flavor, yeah, usually what will happen is that the flavor will mellow. In some cases, if something is left open, sometimes the acid will evaporate. So if it's an open topped container, you'll find the level goes down and you kind of lose the acidic flavor. But if it is still acidic, what's happening is a lot of those flavor compounds are changing over time, and some of the acids, in fact, that aren't the acetic acid can also deteriorate. So the acids and the sharpness can sometimes deteriorate. There are a lot of vinegar makers that age the vinegar. If you think about balsamic, think about really, really good balsamic vinegar. It is acidic, but it's also sweet, and it has a lot of flavor, and it's not super sharp on the tongue, whereas the really liquidy stuff that's sold as balsamic in the supermarkets tends to be pretty sharp. And, you know, one of the big differences between those is time. Some of those really thin balsamics are aged less than 3 years, whereas a really thick, very sweet, older balsamic could be aged 25 years.
Yes, and very expensive.
Yes.
Very expensive. We had chatted earlier through email, Harry, and we had talked about you sharing one of your recipes in your book. And again, I mean, if you're interested in making vinegars or using them, you need to get this book from the library or buy it, whatever. You do such a great job with it, explaining everything, and then again with the recipes. But we talked about sharing your recipe for fish, because, you know, Wisconsin fish fries are, you know, part of the DNA here. And why don't you tell us a little bit about your fish recipe and also the latkes, which are similar to German potatoes or potato pancakes.
Absolutely. So, yeah. You know, for me, one of the vinegars that I started making, because I started out as a home brewer making my own beer, was a malt vinegar. And of course, you know, the first thing that comes to mind, I think, for most people with malt vinegar is fish and chips. Right. Which is something that, you know, you get all over the place in the UK. And, you know, here in the States, you can get fish and chips. When I've had, you know, fried fish and fried potatoes, sometimes there's malt vinegar, but it's not really that. It's often not that good.
Yes.
It's sort of a brown, sharp, you know, vinegary liquid, but it doesn't taste as great as if you make it from real beer. And I wanted to include a fish and chips recipe in the book. I grew up in a Jewish family. And so the time that we had hot oil on the stove was, you know, we always had it for Passover. I mean, not Passover. wrong holiday.
Wrong holiday.
We always had it for Hanukkah, and we always made latkes. We always made potato pancakes. And so I thought, well, here's a great way to have your fried potatoes and have your fried fish in the same recipe as a great way to use vinegar.
That's right.
So, you know, so for me, I mean, you could do this with fries, you could do it with potato chips, but I like to make the latkes. I like to grate the potatoes with onion. You mix in eggs, you mix in some flour, and, you know, you make the potato pancakes. And then for fish, my personal favorite is always smelt and really small fried fish.
Ah.
But for the book, my editor and I decided that something that was, you know, a little more common as far as, like, you know, a piece of fried fish.
Sure,
You know, more fish and chips.
So you can do this on smelt, because that's a pretty big favorite here in Wisconsin, too.
Cool. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So do you want me to quickly say the
Yeah, why don't we go over it really quick, and we will post this on our Facebook page and
Great.
Also on our website after the show. So.
Great. So for the batter, it's 2/3 of a cup of flour, 2 tablespoons of paprika. I like using smoked paprika because it adds kind of a nice depth of flavor, but you can use regular paprika. 1 teaspoon of salt, 1 teaspoon of ground black pepper, 1 egg, 1/2 cup of cold lager beer. I like to use a lager because I don't want beer to overpower the batter. I just want it to get a little bit in there to help hydrate it. 1/4 cup of ice water and 1/4 cup of malt vinegar, homemade or store-bought. And basically, you mix all of those things together to make your batter. And then you dip your fish in there and you fry it in the oil. You know, I like to have my oil at about 365. I find that's a good temperature where you're not going to scorch your oil. And I find you can fry in vegetable oil or lard, kind of up to you. Some people don't like to use lard, but I like frying in lard if you have it around. And I like, you know, for this particular recipe, I mean, like I said, you can use something small like a smelt, but I like to use something like cod or dogfish, and, you know, firm, some kind of a firm white fish. And I like it into about 2-inch square pieces for the recipe.
Yeah.
And then,
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. I was going to say for the latkes, I like to use russet potatoes, about 3 pounds of potatoes, 1 onion, 2 teaspoons of kosher salt, 2 eggs, 2 tablespoons of all-purpose flour, freshly ground black pepper, and mix all of those together. But what I do is I grate the potatoes and the onion together first, and then set them over a bowl in a colander, and it'll drain out a lot of liquid. And you want to squeeze as much liquid out as possible. And I usually leave it there for, you know, 5 or 10 minutes or so. Then what will happen in the liquid is the liquid will actually separate, and you will have water, and then you will have this layer of starch that ends up in the bottom of the bowl, and you'll have this very hard white starch. So I pour the water off, and then I add the starch back in to the potatoes and the onions, and then add the other ingredients, the salt, the flour, the eggs, the pepper, and mix everything together. And I find that extra starch that settles to the bottom, because it's so fine, it mixes in and helps bind everything together when you fry it.
And that sounds so good. And the picture in here makes me want to go out and get some fish and potato pancakes or something like that for lunch. So
And then you need to have a nice cold beer with it.
There you go. And we've got plenty of that here in Wisconsin, so that should not be a problem. Well, Harry, this has been so much fun, and we're basically out of time at this point. I hope you can talk with us again.
I'd love to.
How can we hear your podcast?
So you can find my podcast. It's called Feast Your Ears. And it's on Heritage Radio Network.
Okay.
So you can look at that. And it's a show where I interview people about their life and food and sort of what they do.
Oh.
And if anybody hears this after the fact, or besides they have any other questions, I also have a vinegar hotline that you can call.
Great.
You can call 1-800-248-0513, and you can get directly to me during certain hours, or you can leave me a message, and I'll get back to you with any questions you have about vinegar.
Well, that's wonderful. We've been talking with Harry Rosenblum and about his new book. It's called Vinegar Revival, Artisanal Recipes for Brightening Dishes and Drinks with Homemade Vinegar. Thanks again, Harry. And coming up next, we're going to be talking about something completely different. It's mindfulness. So stay with us here on the Ideas Network.